So, reverse grids in World Superbikes. That did the trick then. Welcome to Bike Live on Motorsport 101. Let's go! And welcome everybody to episode 3 of Bike Live here on Motorsport 101 as we get closer and closer to the MotoGP season getting underway. Our season preview comes next week, but on this show, we will look back on the final preseason test in Qatar as Maverick Viñales' domination of the winter was complete as he topped 4 out of 4 preseason tests. We'll talk about all the stories coming from that test, including what the hell that was on the front of the Ducati and so much more. But we'll also be here to talk World Superbikes as Jonathan Rea crushed the opposition again, making a complete mockery of the reverse grid rules with another pole and 2 more victories, and how Chaz Davies appeared to have learned his lesson, but maybe he hasn't, as he crashed in race 2. So much to talk about from the two races in Thailand, as well as another crackers World Superbot race, which was saw another first-time winner in the form of Federico Caracasulo, but that doesn't even tell you the half of it, what happened in World Supersport. Inside note on this week's show, as I welcome Andre Harrison once again. Welcome, Dre.
Hello, everybody.
I think there's
an elephant in the room here we have to address straight away, don't we?
Yeah, there's an elephant in the room and there is a co-host not in the room. This is going to be a bit of an interesting show for you because this is a recorded podcast, but yes, there is an element of live to this. If we hear from Rebecca James during this show, we're going to straight up call her up and get her on this podcast. That's a bit of an interesting tease to see if she turns up. Will Rebecca James appear over the next 2 hours? We shall wait and see, because we desperately want to get her back on the show.
If you do, Bex,
please come back.
We miss you, almost.
We miss you, yeah. Just see the look on Dre's face on Twitter when he heard you were coming on.
you had to bring this up.
He was so excited. Yeah, welcome to the internet's latest meme, Andre Harrison. Just to mark your card for all the different ways you can get in touch with us, you can find us on our website, motorsport101.net. On Twitter, we're at motorsport_101. If you want to follow us personally on Twitter, I'm at LewisSudderby23, Dre is Harrison101HD, and Bex, it's at Beck_J93. Other than that, you can find us on Facebook, facebook.com/motorsport101. We're on YouTube, youtube.com/motorsport101, where you can find weekly highlights from the shows. And if you want to back us financially, if you like us that much, you can back us on Patreon by heading to patreon.com/motorsport101. Where your contribution will earn you many, many cool perks, including early access to this and indeed Motorsport 101, which are both weekly from here on in for the rest of the motorsport season. And next week is a huge week for us, Dre, on Motorsport 101, because the MotoGP and Formula One seasons are right around the corner.
Yeah, it's season preview week next week, so inevitably we're going to have about 16 hours worth of podcasts for you. And it's worth mentioning that if you enjoyed my highly excited face, we added a new Patreon goal next month. We get to $100 a month total Patreon backing support. I promised I would do one show a week. So if you liked my highly excited face, you can see more of it if you back us financially.
I thought you were going to put that on a T-shirt. That would be That's worth $100 alone.
Oh, come on now.
If that happens. Head to patreon.com/motorsport101. It's got a full breakdown of all the different tiers and how you can back the show, or should I say shows, Bike Live and Motorsport 101. We're having fun here, but unfortunately we have to start with some very, very sad news in the motorsport world. Since we were last with you here on Bike Live, Dre, the motorsport world lost one of its giants. It lost John Surtees. The only man in history to win the Formula One and Grand Prix Motorcycle Racing World Championships. We're going to talk about him on Motorsport 101 as well, which comes to you later in the week. But as a motorcycle racer, he was one of the greats, wasn't he? I mean, 4-time Grand Prix Motorcycle Racing World Champion, one of the absolute giants of MV Agusta's time as a Grand Prix Motorcycle Racing team, and just a guy that motorsport's going to sadly miss.
Absolutely. One of the most unique and incredible talents that British motorsport has ever had. I mean, again, the four Grand Prix world titles, probably most relevant in the case of this show, but obviously also the 1964 Formula One world champion. You know, again, super talent for Le Mans as well, did sports cars brilliantly. Just one of the most versatile and unique talents that we're never going to see a guy like Surtees again. The way our culture and society is now, we're all so specialised in everything that we're never going to see another complete all-rounder on two wheels and four like John Surtees ever again. It's a damn shame he missed out on a knighthood, because I think he was more than worthy of getting one. And I know many people have pulled for that, and sadly it never quite happened. Maybe posthumously he'll get a knighthood, who knows, but in any case, an incredible pioneer of motorsport and an icon that we're not going to forget. And from all the reports I've ever read from friends of the show and from people that I've been around, a truly, truly nice man as well. And shout out to friend of the show Tom Brooks, who mentioned, so I spoke to him about this as well, and mentioned how what a delightful guy he was to be around. And again, he's done tremendous work for charity as well, of the Henry Surtees Foundation, in honor of his son, as well. So again, just a truly great guy, and obviously just a complete motorsport legend in total. So rest in peace, John, and I hope the legacy of your foundation lives on, because they've done incredible work, and again, very important work regarding head trauma and brain injuries as well in motorsport, which is sadly becoming more and more common. But in any case, a total legend. And man, I know that word gets thrown around a lot these days in sporting context, but that's exactly what John Surtees was, is, and always will be.
Yeah, and that's one kind of nice thing from it all, is through the Henry Surtees Foundation, his legacy and the legacy, obviously, of his son, who also lost his life in motorsport, will continue to live on. And we would encourage you all, if you possibly can, please donate to the Henry Surtees Foundation. It does some fantastic work, not just in motorsport, but just in the wider public sphere.
Here's what I'm going to do, side of me, by the way. Sorry to cut you, but here's what I'm going to do. For every play that Motorsport 101 gets on SoundCloud next week, so that'll be the week of the 23rd, I want to say. What day is it today? Today's the 15th we record this. So today is Wednesday. The week of the 20th. So from the week of the 20th to the 27th, for every play we get on the podcast, I'll donate 5p to the Henry Surtees Foundation. So that's my way of giving a little something back to the Henry Surtees Foundation. Again, I've personally raised money for it before, and it's an incredible foundation, and again, a very important one, because as a sports fan, like, head traumas and brain injuries is something that is still such an untapped world, and it needs research. It absolutely needs research, because we've had some horrible accidents, some very big near misses, like Danilo Petrucci last year, which could have been so much worse than what it was, given he was clearly concussed but allowed to continue. Like, we need to keep investigating this, so that's what I'm going to do. So let that go on the record from now, basically.
Yeah, the motorsport world will sorely miss Don Surtees, who, as I mentioned, lost his life on the 10th of March at the age of 83. Unfortunately, he wasn't the only star of motorsport or motorcycle racing to lose his life since we were last with you. We also lost one of the titans of endurance motorcycle racing, Anthony Dallal, who was one of the stars of the dominant Suzuki Endurance Racing Team, which has dominated endurance motorcycle racing for a number of years now. Dallal was testing for that very team in France this week, or last week, at the Nogaro circuit, where he unfortunately suffered an accident and succumbed to his injuries. As I mentioned, Dallal was a star of the Endurance World Championship team, winning 5 titles with the Suzuki team, including last year. And as I say, one of the absolute stalwarts of endurance racing in motorcycle racing, which has such a following. It's such a great discipline to watch. Obviously, we're such big fans here on Motorsport 101 Bike Live of the Suzuka 8-hour. But the championship as a whole, it's such a great championship to watch. Endurance racing on motorcycles is actually very, very good fun to watch. And Dallal was one of the absolute heroes of that. And unfortunately, he lost his life too this week at the age of 35. So our thoughts go to him and to his family and loved ones. Right, let's talk motorcycle racing then. If we could try and move on. Obviously, it's a very, very sad week for motorcycle racing. Well, let's try and entertain you and put some smiles on some faces by talking World Superbikes, Dre. And no one will have a bigger smile on their face this week than Jonathan Rea, who, he told us, didn't he, over the winter, how good a winter he had, how well prepared he was for this season. We're kind of getting the confirmation of that, aren't we now? Not only was he so good in Phillip Island, pulling out two clutch victories, but he absolutely crushed them in Thailand.
Beat him down. There's no other way of describing it, really. That was Jonathan Rea at his apocalyptic best. And again, when everything clicks for Jonathan Rea, he's unbeatable. Like, there is no more unbeatable force, I think, in the entirety of two-wheeled motorsport racing. He was dominant, and you could tell from practice that this was going to be a good weekend for him. The race simulations he was running in practice and the consistency that he was putting out. Like, the man was a full metronome out there. It was ridiculous. Laps after laps and, like, within a tenth of each other, and then he was getting faster towards the end of his stint. Like, he broke the practice lap record in free practice one. And he was, again, when it came to the races, he was the only man consistently in the 33s. And there was no answer for him. Absolutely nothing anybody could do about him. Like, everybody else had to override their bikes to keep up. And we saw what happened with Marco Melandri, where he was trying so hard to keep up. He made mistakes and he fell back down the order as a result. She should have just known straight away that Jonathan was not going to be beaten today. And like, the Kawasaki is an excellent race bike. It's very good around Thailand. It has been. And just the fact that, you know, Jonathan is clued in with his bike, and like, he's curb stomping Tom Sykes right now as well in terms of on track pace as well, which says a lot. It's not just the bike. Jonathan is just getting the maximum out of this thing every weekend now. And it's a terrifying thought that he's this quick on a Thailand where last year it was two very competitive races. This year, nobody had an answer for him.
No. And no one had an answer for him, as you say, at any stage of the weekend. As you mentioned, he was quickest in every session as the weekend went on, every session that he competed in, because obviously he wasn't in Super Bowl 1. Super Bowl 2 is an interesting one, of course, because that's twice now where we've encouraged our listeners to bet the mortgage on Tom Sykes, and we've let them down again.
Sorry.
Mitigating circumstances this time, though, in the bizarre scenario for a world championship in motorsport to have some of its tyres damaged in transit, the qualifying tyres, which were damaged in transit on their way to Buriram. So the replacements were flown in. They got stuck at customs. So basically they had to withdraw the qualifying tyre from the allocation, which meant that Tom Sykes is the chief weapon in his arsenal for the weekend was taken out of play.
Yes. You're not mad about that at all, are you, Sadabi?
Not even slightly, no. he still managed to qualify second to his credit, Tom Sykes. But Jonathan Rea, by dint of the fact that they were qualifying on effectively soft race tyres, which Jonathan Rea was phenomenally quick on, saw him take pole position ahead of his teammate. So a second Kawasaki 1-2. In fact, the top three on the grid, the front row, was identical to Phillip Island, with Marco Melandri in third place. Chaz Davies qualifying on the second row again. My sort of tongue-in-cheek prediction on the season preview that Chaz Davies may not start on a front row all year is starting to look even more true than I realised. Because that's two rounds down. He still hasn't started on a front row of the grid all year. He's only been on the second and the third row in the first four races of the season. Into race one then, and Jonathan Rea pretty much did what we all feared he would, Dre. Because in Phillip Island, he knew that he couldn't get away. No one could get away. So there was no point trying to go out and do a time attack at the front. So Jonathan Rea didn't even try to do that. He basically admitted to himself that he was going to be in a pack race and raced accordingly. But there was none of that in Thailand, was there? It was basically go from the gun and see if anybody can keep up.
Yeah, he got a fantastic start, had the confidence to sweep around the outside and take the whole shot, and then just didn't look back. It was a matter of, it was like watching Jorge Lorenzo go to work, where it's on a track where you know Lorenzo is comfortable, like Le Mans, for example, because he tends to dominate around there an awful lot. Like, He basically just said, I'm going to go as fast as I possibly can here. Let's see if you can keep up. And nobody had an answer for him. No one.
Yeah, you like, just saw that, that gap gradually just grow and grow and grow, didn't you? As the guys, as each guy sort of, as they wilted under the pressure that Ray was putting on them.
Yeah, exactly. And Ray had the pace. He went out. Melandri tried to keep up. And then all of a sudden, he lost a lap. He lost the second on the lap when he went too wide around the corner. And then that deal, the race was done. It was over right there and then. And yeah, Jonathan would go on to win by a handful of seconds. And again, made it look very, very easy. Just brilliant stuff from Jonathan. Again, just his pace, his race pace was just out of this world compared to everybody else. And the fact, again, only man in the 33s, broke the lap record in the process. Just ridiculous stuff from Jonathan Rea. No man had an answer for him. And again, like I said, everybody else had to override to try and keep up. And when you're overriding, you're going to make mistakes. And that's what Melandri did on two separate occasions this weekend.
Yeah, just looking at the race one result from the weekend. And Jonathan Rea won that opening race by 6.2 seconds. From Chaz Davies. That's a Chaz Davies level of dominance that we saw in that first race from Jonathan Rea, and that's 6.2 seconds in a 20-lap race. He was just that dominant over the course of race one. Race two was slightly different in that it was red flagged early on. We'll cover these sort of stories in a bit. But first, we saw Chaz Davies trying to go after Melandri, who, by dint of Sykes' last corner pass on him, which we'll come back to later on, that put Melandri on race two pole ahead of the two Yamahas. So Chaz Davies tried to go with his teammate. Jonathan Rea, likewise, having gone from ninth to fourth in one corner.
God's sake!
Off the start line. That comes back to what I said at the top of the show about these reverse grid rules really making a difference in World Superbikes this year. So Rea and Chaz get to the front. They're with Melandri. Tom Sykes, actually, to his credit, he also managed to make his way through the pack a little better this time than he had in Phillip Island. So they're up with Melandri. Chaz actually passes Jonathan Rea for second, but as he's trying to sort of make a move on Melandri, knowing that he's probably going to have to try and get out front and try and gap them while Jonathan Rea is stuck in traffic, Chaz goes down, dropping to the back of the field, but he's bailed out by a red flag for Lorenzo Savadori's Aprilia, which had spilled oil all over its own rear tyre and catapulted him into the air at the final corner. Debris and oil everywhere. Red flag comes out. Chaz Davies gets another go, but obviously from the back of the grid this time. And in that 16-lap restart, Jonathan Rea, not quite as dominant, but he still had a comfortable margin, Dre.
At no point was that I ever think Jonathan's not going to win this race. Like that it was still very straightforward. Not quite as dominant second time round. Melandri did put up a better fight of it second time round. But I don't know how much of that was Jonathan just taking it easy. At no point did I see Jonathan think, I've got to ride on 100% here, because he just didn't have to. Because the thing is, the key for that one for me was that Rea absolutely nailed the start. And it was probably the best start of his life, seeing that coming from ninth. And then the fact he was third by the turn three hairpin. Obviously, Chaz going back to knocking back down to fourth again. But
second
the fact
in lap one. Like that double pass at the end of the final lap on Lowe's and Chaz.
It's like, how is he capable of doing that?
Like standing still.
Yeah, like the Kawasaki just had this knack of having this incredible slingshot off the penultimate corner and being able to pass people at will into the final bend, as we'll get to with Tom Sykes in a minute. But again, just if you're passing Alex Lowes and Chaz Davies, two of the finest riders in the class. Sorry, Max. I'll give you that the compliment. But it's one of those things where, like, they're two top-tier riders, and you can just pass them at ease like that. Jonathan's making this field look silly at the moment. It's not a good look for everybody right now. Like, guys, come on, everybody. Beat this man, please, for our own good.
Yeah, do try and keep up. But unfortunately, they couldn't. And where are we at here, Dre? Not just with Jonathan Rea, but with this championship for this season. I mean, Chaz Davies has, well, until race two happened, he was doing the job that we all hoped he would of. Even if he's finishing a mile back, let's just finish second. Just keep the damage down. Just keep the points to the points gap to a minimum. Race two kind of blew that apart a little bit, although he still got sixth. But Jonathan Rea has dominated each of the last two championship seasons, but in neither of those did he win the first four races. This is his best ever start.
That's a terrifying thought that, yeah, Jonathan has dominated, but he was never the best starter, especially given that Aragon is coming up next, and that's been Chaz Davis
land. 2 years ago, Haslam beat him in Phillip Island Race 2 in that photo finish, and last year, Sykes stopped his winning streak at 3 in Thailand Race 2.
Yeah, exactly. And this year he's won 4 for 4 and with relative ease. And that's going to be the part of the problem. It's like Jonathan's, like, he's even patching up some of the very few holes in his game, like the qualifying issues, where he's had 2 poor positions so far to start the season, and the pack racing situation. He's blown people apart on the opening laps of race 2 to the point where the handicap is almost non-existent, where he's starting from maybe 8th or 9th. Well, it's been 9th every time so far because he's won both race 1 so far this season, but both times he's been in the top 5 within the first lap, so it almost doesn't matter. So when you combine all of that and then Chaz Davis's mistake, I mean, why did Chaz try so hard to pass his own teammate that early on? I do not understand why he's going into that hairpin so hot to try and stop Melandri. One, who is his teammate, and 2, it was lap 4, or lap 3, I think, when it happened.
Because you could see that crash. You could see it happening from about 100 metres back, couldn't you?
Yeah, it's like you knew Chaz had gone in too hot. You could tell he'd gone in too. I know that was his line for the weekend, but you could see he was going too hot, and he was wrestling with the bike to try and keep it upright, and he loses the back, and I'm like, oh yeah, there we go again, Chaz. Oh, for goodness sake, why are you trying so hard here? Yeah. Like,
just take the points, my man.
Take the points. Like, no one's going to kill you for finishing third here. I mean, so far, Chaz has done a very good job of taking said points. I mean, he had 3 second places going in to race 2 in Thailand, and now he's lost out 15 points to Jonathan Rea, and he's now, what, I think 30 points off the top of the championship
Especially with Aragon next, where he flattened them last year.
Exactly.
Chaz Davis winning both races. And let's pick up on that, because like we said in Phillip Island, or after Phillip Island, that Chaz Davis looks to have learned his lesson. He looks to have, you know, noted that last year he lost that championship with those kind of moments like we saw in Phillip Island, where he went down trying to win a race that probably wasn't there to win.
Right.
And gave away, well, he went from 2nd to 10th in that second race in Phillip Island last year and cost himself 15, 14 points. And let's be fair here, Dre, if Sir Savadori's bike hadn't have blown up and brought out a red flag, he probably wouldn't have scored anything at all in race 2 either.
Yeah, because the gaps between him and
bailed out big time.
Yeah, him and the points. He was way, way off the points in terms of just track position by the time that Savadori's red flag came out. That was like Chaz admitted it himself. He got very lucky that red flag was there. Otherwise, he probably would have scored only minor points at best. And that's the thing. Yeah, exactly. And that's the thing. Chaz's race pace in race 2 wasn't particularly special. I mean, he struggled to get past Leon Camia for a good chunk of that race, and he did not have an answer for Jordi Torres on the BMW.
What did you call it during the race? The Great Wall of Camia.
The Great Wall of Camia. You shall not be moved. Like, and it was only really like Camia having mechanical gremlins before his engine went completely pop, before Chaz Davis could comfortably cleared him. And again, he could not find the way around Spanish Elvis. So Chaz didn't look particularly strong in race 2 either, which is a concern given that that's your main title threat. Remember what I said about 3 weeks ago when I said that Melandri would be more of a hassle than people thought? Just throwing that out there.
Yeah, Melandri's 2-0 now in qualifying or in Super Bowl against Chaz Davis, and he obviously beat him for the first time with that result in race 2. Of course, Chaz beating Melandri to second in race 1. So we thought. We looked like we're going to have a double Ducati podium with Melandri finishing third. But Melandri looked like he completely goosed his tyres trying to keep up with Jonathan Rea in that first race. And he fell back quite dramatically towards the end, to the point that Tom Sykes reeled him in a corner from home to snatch the final podium position. But at least the guy, Dre, of Marco Melandri's class wouldn't be caught out by the same move twice, right?
Of course not. Like, that would never happen to a guy's experience as much. Oh, there it is. It's almost like, oh no, like Marco must be suffering from deja vu at this rate. And you could see like Marco punching his fuel tank in frustration as he comes over the line, knowing he's basically given up the ghost on 2 separate occasions.
So I'd have thought Marco on the pit wall. That's what worried me about Marco.
Marco, why didn't you throw the block? I mean, just veer to the right on that one and block the apex, and you're probably going to finish in third anyway, because you can't pass around the outside of that final corner. It's impossible. So I'm Marco was, I think, just caught hot dogging more than anything else. And next thing you know, Tom Sykes is beating him over the line for the second time in three races. And that's, oh dear, it's not a good look for Marco. It's a shame because he had a pretty darn good weekend, finishing fourth and third in both races. Had a good weekend. He needed it after the race one incident in Phillip Island. But he's going to be, as a racer, he'll be gutted that he gave up the same move twice to a fellow title rival in Tom Sykes. And yeah, just disappointing. It was the most disappointing third place finish I think I've ever seen from a rider, where he's punching his fuel tank as he comes on the podium. Says a lot, really, doesn't it?
Yeah, two rounds though for Marco Melandri and two podiums for him. And you know, had he not been involved in that collision with Alex Lowes in race one in Phillip Island, he might have had three out of the first four. So one thing's for sure, Ducati are pretty much getting what they hoped for out of Marco Melandri, aren't they? They've got two strong riders now, rather than one strong rider and one sort of wild card on the other bike.
Yeah, like there's consistency there with Marco now, and again, he probably would have been in the top four again if it weren't for that Alex Lowes collision, which was unfortunate and unlucky. But again, he's been in the top four every race since. You can't really ask for much more than that. Kawasaki is still probably the best bike in the field on paper, so third is about the par score for Melandri. So if you can finish in fourth and finish in the top four every round, then great, you've got a double-pronged attack for the title. As long as you keep the mistakes down and you limit the mistakes, you'll be fine. So, yeah, like Davide Giuliano, as we talked about last year, was inconsistent. He had moments where he was challenging for wins and had great pace and, you know, had the upside shown, but a lot, he couldn't, one, win a race, and two, like, next day he'd be down in 8th or 9th, way below where the bike should be. So if Melandri is a better baseline of what the bike can do, then they'll only benefit in the long run by having a guy like him there within the team.
Tom Sykes this weekend then, it was Sykes that put the two moves on Melandri to snatch third in race one, second in race two. And let's first talk about another curious sort of end to race one for Tom Sykes, because we talked about this after Phillip Island, and we both noticed this on Twitter at the end of race one. The thought process for Sykes, he effectively blew race two pole at the final corner of race one.
Right.
Which is an interesting one. As it turned out, it probably wouldn't have made a difference, because he was second anyway in race two to Jonathan Rea. And part of me wondered afterwards, thinking, would it have even been worse for Tom Sykes had he gone on race two pole with Rea in ninth and still been beaten by him? Would that have been even worse for him? But what did you think of that at the time, where Tom Sykes is sat in an easy fourth at the end of race one, yet he takes the extra 3 points and a bottle of champagne when he had race two pole in his pocket?
Yeah, I'm not. We mentioned this in the preview that, you know, for a guy like Sykes who is running out of tools quickly to beat Jonathan Rea, maybe the last roll of the dice would be to take a fourth place and start race two from pole and hope Jonathan has trouble trying to pass people. Again, I also said that Tom Sykes is a proper racer and he would never do something like that. And I proved out to be right on both cases. I think Tom probably made a mistake on that one. I think he would probably have been slightly better off if he had instead just waited it out and take the fourth place. Okay, you lose 3 points by doing so, but at the same time, you probably get those back by starting race two from pole position, where you can dictate the pace of the race, you can control it, you can go from there, and you probably don't have to worry about your teammate so much because he's starting the race from ninth. Again, don't think it would have made a massive difference, but in any case, I think Sykes probably made a bad call by going for the podium, because, you know, I think Sykes has got to figure the long game here, and he's hemorrhaging points here at a very rapid pace. And yeah, like that might have been, in hindsight, a bad move for the overall championship.
Yeah, because like I said, I looked at it at the time and I thought, big mistakes. I was thinking, your only chance of beating Jonathan Rea, you're not going to beat Jonathan Rea from the third row, but if you're on pole and he's ninth, you might just be a couple of seconds up the road by the time he gets through the traffic. Now, like I say, as it happened on this day in history, it wouldn't have mattered because A, Jonathan Rea was up to second by the end of the first lap anyway, and we got the red flag, which reset the grid. So it effectively put Jonathan Rea back on pole again because he was leading when the red flag came out. So it probably wouldn't have made a difference to him in this weekend. But I was just surprised at the time that Sykes, he's clearly just thinking of podiums. He's thinking of, you know, getting everything he can out of every race rather than thinking of race two, which like I say, I was sat there thinking, Just take race two pole. You're going to be on race two pole with two Yamahas next to you that clearly aren't a threat. As good as they've been, they're not going to beat you in race two. And they might just play a spoiler for you in that second race. But looking at his weekend in a whole and his season so far, he's third in the points, is Tom Sykes. And he's already got quite a gap to make up to his teammate Jonathan Rea, which, of course, is kind of similar story to the first 2 years. But it's, I mean, he trails by 38 points. Sykes is on 62 points to Jonathan Rea's perfect 100. But that's the thing. Jonathan Rea is perfect. And it's, yes. I'm finding it hard to be too critical of Tom Sykes here, given that his teammate is on such a high level.
Well, what can you say?
What could he do?
What can you, like, if the guy in front of you has won all four races, minimum you're going to be 20 points back. And Sykes, if you take Jonathan Rea out of the equation here, has done a pretty solid job so far. He's gotten a couple of results over Chaz Davis, and he's finished on the podium twice in the season so far. And, you know, he's doing a good job for the team. And again, it's just a situation where if Jonathan is that good, anything less than perfect is going to get shown up to be like two or three times worse than it is on paper, because Jonathan has literally not put a foot wrong so far this season. And yeah, I mean, again, Sykes is this going to be a new role for Sykes as being like the backup guy now, like the cleanup man, like Danny Pedrosa is, maybe? I don't know, but I don't think Sykes would ever want to admit that in public, that Jonathan is just kicking his butt in right now. But it's that might be the impromptu, inadvertent new role for Tom Sykes, is the cleanup man, because at the moment Jonathan Rea is looking, he's outclassing him. There's no other way of describing it, and that's a shame, but everybody's being outclassed by him right now. So, like, in the context of the battle for second, maybe Sykes has done a pretty fine job so far, and he's made the best of what's been given to him, which is a shame, because it's not all gone his way at all this season, given like Phillip Island and given the qualifying tire mix up in Thailand, which apparently they're still over there getting checked over by customs as we speak. But yeah, in any case, it's a shame, but Tom's made a, he's been dealt a pretty bad hand, given the rules, given the changes, and he's still competitive, which says a lot about Sykes as a class of rider. It's just a shame that Jonathan is having a historically good season so far. To put it into perspective, Jonathan Rea has finished on the podium 90% of the time since joining Kawasaki. 90%, and the man averages 20 points a race for Kawasaki right now. That's second place.
How can you beat that?
It's practically unstoppable. Yeah, mathematically, it's almost impossible to beat that. If one guy's averaging 20 points a race, it's just...
It tells us the level we're at, where we're almost looking at a third and a second as a bad weekend, which is what Tom Sykes came out of Thailand with. Third and second was good, but not quite good enough. If he wants to win this championship this season, it's already starting to look like an uphill climb for both he and Chaz Davies. Yamaha, they're not a championship threat this year, but in terms of the pecking order in World Superbikes, they're solidly the third best at the moment, aren't they, Dre?
Yeah, I mean, I've talked about this in my post on motorsport101.net regarding this, that Yamaha are clearly the third best team in the field now, and like, they have, again, nothing against Ginters, but they have two solid riders again here, and their bikes, like, it's a shame that Vandermark missed out in race two because of that oil. I think it was an oil spill of some kind that they couldn't let him take the restart after the red flag came out. But in any case, Yamaha's been competitive, and they've been more competitive than they were this time last year. This time last year, they were 20 seconds off the win. They've halved the distance in that over the course of a 20-lap race in the space of a calendar year. And as we saw in Phillip Island, instead of being in 6th to 8th place, they were up there challenging for the win, in the case of Lowe's at least anyway. So Yamaha has definitely made great progress this year and are now become the established third-best team. And I know they'll probably squeeze a couple of podiums out here and there over the course of the season, I reckon. So they've got a good team. Lowe's is having a very good season so far. He's up there in that mix for second right now, which is as good as you can really ask for right now. So yeah, like, the Yamaha haven't really gone very far wrong so far at all. I mean, again, reliability could be a little bit of work there with Vandermark and his engine issues there, but they've got a good package there, and they've definitely made, I'd argue, the most progress of any bike in the field this year. So that's when Yamaha need to be making gains, and luckily they are.
They are, and I think they've done a tremendous job, and I think their bike's at a spot now where, as you say, they were 10 seconds off the win, and that's 10 seconds off Jonathan Rea, who was quite a class above the rest of them. So take him out of the play, they were sort of 3-4 seconds off Chaz Davies and Tom Sykes, which is terrific for them. I think they're at the point now where they might just pinch a win somewhere if one of their riders has an inspired day. Vandermark Assen. I think they're just about good enough when we get to there that Vandermark might just be in the argument somewhere in those races, because that's another of those races where, to quote Tom Sykes, we'll have a love train at the front of the race. We're not going to have a sort of Jonathan Rea runaway and hide job at Assen. So I can't wait till we get to there, because I think Vandermark's going to be right in the shake-up there. I'd probably say the same for Alex Lowes at Donington as well, but then Tom Sykes exists, so that probably won't happen. Yeah. I think they're at a point now where if one of their riders has a special race, they might just nick a result. And they've twice now had front rows, haven't they, in race two?
And
Phillip Island came close, like Alex Lowes came close to translating that into a win or into a podium, couldn't quite do it. Thailand, of course, was a very, very different story because we had the red flag, which reset the grid and undid all that. But as far as Alex Lowes is concerned, Dre, this is the part of the show, of course, where we really wish Becks were here. But Vandermark beat him for the first time in Thailand race one. But if we look at Lowes' season so far, he's gone 4th, 4th, 6th, 4th. Which, as starts go, you can't really ask for much more for him than that.
Yeah, on the third best bike in the field, that's a very good run of form so far. And again, like Sykes, you can't really ask for much more than that in the context of the bike and where you are in the field right now. So yeah, Lowes has had a very, very good start to the season. You know, four top six finishes and three out of the four races so far in the top four. It's a lot like Vandermark this time last year when he was on the Honda, where the best of the rest guy was Vandermark on the Honda. And right now, Lowes is the best of the rest of the guys that are on the Kawasaki and the Ducatis right now. Like, right now, Lowes is up there fighting with the best of them right now. So if he keeps racking up the points, he could surprise a few people at this rate. And I think, like you said, with the race two rules, with those situations where Yamaha are getting those front row starts in race two, one of these days, like, Lowes is going to have a day where he can win because his pace is that good. So I think it will happen. It could happen at some point this year for sure. Maybe somewhere like Assen, maybe somewhere like Jerez, that could definitely come into play. There's a lot to be happy about in that Yamaha camp, if you ask me.
Yeah, because as good as that first lap was for Jonathan Rea, and as phenomenal as that was to get through the pack of that first lap, I struggle to think that that's going to happen everywhere. Surely somewhere it's going to be a little trickier for Jonathan Rea to pick his way through. Surely all it'll take is one of these race twos is for Jonathan Rea to have a bad start, which he ironically had in race one in Phillip Island, where he dropped back through the field on the first lap. All it takes is for that to happen on a race two for Jonathan Rea, and he ends up sort of 12th or 13th on lap one, and that's about it. He's not going to get back through from there. So I think if Yamaha keep putting themselves in that position, keep putting themselves in position to have that front row for race two, I think it's going to pay off eventually. It's going to get them a result somewhere if they keep taking their chances, and they're clearly putting themselves in that position on a regular basis now with the third best bike. Difficult to really argue who the fourth best bike is, but Jordi Torres made a decent argument for this weekend that it might well be the BM.
Yeah, like BMW just have this knack right now where, okay, they're not factory supporting their bikes, which is a real shame, but because they have a very good team there. Marcus Reiterberger and Jordi Torres are doing the Lord's work on that BMW.
It's some of its parts, that team.
Absolutely. And given what they've got around them, Torres and Reiterberger are talented dudes. That's for sure. And Torres, again, he just has this knack of putting out some really great results every now and again. And that fifth place in race two was a superb result for BMW. Mm. Holding off the Chaz Davies on a factory Ducati bike for pretty much the entire second half of the race. Superb job from Torres. And yeah, BMW, they might be the fourth best bike in the field right now with the Altea team, which, given, again, that's a satellite team with no factory support from BMW themselves. That's an absolutely outstanding job from Torres and Reiterberger, and definitely one to keep an eye on.
Yeah, really will keep an eye on. And Reiterberger, I didn't realise how young he was. He's only 23, is Reiterberger, which in World Superbike terms, he's very young. Just a week ago, and when you look at the likes of Rea and Sykes and Davies, who are pushing 30, he's in that sort of, I kind of feel bad for not mentioning him in that sort of Vandermark Lowe's bracket, because he's that sort of age, and he's on a arguably inferior bike to them.
Yeah, he's on a far worse bike in terms of pure performance than anything Lowe's had the last couple of years. You know, so yeah, like, I didn't realize Reiterberger is, you know, still only turned 23 last week.
He's not quite as consistent, but on his day, he's just as quick.
Yeah, on his day, he's absolutely a top eight level guy. Absolutely, no question. So, yeah, they've got a lot to look forward to in that BMW game. It kind of just begs me, but BMW, why can't any factory support these bikes? I don't think it would be that expensive. And, you know, I'll take a good unit, and you've got two talented and a very marketable Jordi Torres on your team. One of the few people that people actually care about in World Superbikes, given how funny he is. Okay. Like, you've got talent there. You've got something in that unit there. So why not invest in that? You've got something. You know, absolutely. So it's a shame, but all he can do is just keep producing these great results, and who knows what could happen one day.
Yeah, Altea have won championships in this thing. They took Carlos Checa to a world title in World Superbikes. They know what they're doing.
Absolutely. They're a good team.
And given that they are squeezing every last drop out of that BMW at the moment and doing a terrific job with it and continuing to show us up for our preseason prediction that they may fall back. Because two rounds out of two now, where they've got both riders straight into Super Bowl 2. Which not many teams could say they've done that. And not only done that, because, you know, Yamaha have done that, Vandermark had to go through P1 in Phillip Island. And yeah, they're doing a terrific job. Honda are getting there, I suppose. Nicky Hayden taking their best result so far with the new Fireblade, 7th place in race 1, which doesn't sound particularly great, Dre, but it's baby steps for this team, isn't it?
In the context of Honda's struggles and the Tenkate's struggles this season, that was a superb weekend for Nicky Hayden. Genuine progress made there. I mean, I know Hayden was running roughly in that sort of ballpark before the race 1 crash in Australia, but Honda are mixing up with where they need to be. That zone of BMW, Yamaha, you know, like Leon Camier's MV, that's the kind of area they need to be getting to. And that you got to start from there, because that's kind of where they were last year. So, yeah, for Hayden to finish, to get two top 10 finishes on that Honda, which again is still in a developmental period, they still are, you know, not where they want or need to be right now, they'll take it. I think that's a very, there was a lot of patted backs in that Honda garage after that result. So, yeah, they've clearly made some progress. They're only going to get better as time goes on. So Hayden's given them a nice little shot in the arm with that. It was a very, very solid result. Stefan, on the other hand.
Bradl, who's, we can't even talk about him as being the best German, can we? Now we just praise Reiterberger. But, yeah, Bradl's having a tough time of it, unfortunately, in World Superbikes at the moment. I don't think it's quite the project he thought he'd signed up for when he joined Honda. But he's probably going to have to be a bit patient with that one. We can't move on from World Superbikes without talking about the Great Wall of Camier. And yet again, I mean, his haircut doesn't particularly impress many with that sort of headband that he has in. As James Whittam, I think it was, who said at the weekend, he's looking more and more Italian by the weekend within that Italian MV Agusta team. But while that's not particularly impressive, his riding continues to impress us.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, like, I know Shaky was a little bit down on him on the punditry, saying there's no baseline for it, but let's just take it for what it is. We all know MV is a very small factory. We all know that they only have the budget for one bike, and they're not going to be able to keep up with Yamaha's, Kawasaki, Ducati, etc. So for Camier again to be mixing up in the top 10 on that MV.
And he lost Friday again.
Yeah, practically no running on Friday either. And again, he's just gone out there, ridden the nuts off it, and got in the top 10. I mean, he's doing an excellent job. It's just a shame the engine blew up in race 2, because, again, he was running in 7th place in that race as well. And again, it just popped out on him, which is a shame, because he's carrying an entire factory on his back right now, and he's doing an excellent, excellent job. And it's just a shame that MV has let him down more than he's let them down, because, again, he's doing an absolutely excellent job.
Fantastic job for Leon Camier. And, what he suffered was, in fact, the second factory MV Agusta to go pop that day. We'll tell you what the other one was in just a moment. But here's how race 1 ended up then. From the weekend, Jonathan Rowe the winner by a mile from Chaz Davies and Tom Sykes, who rounded out the podium. Identical race 1 result to Phillip Island, incidentally. Malandrian 4th, ahead of Vandermark and Lowe's, the Yamaha's 5th and 6th, Torres 7th, Camier 8th, And then the Hondas of Hayden and Bradle, 9th and 10th. So Bradle did at least get a top 10 out of his weekend. Race 2 finished like this. Ray, the winner, leading on a Kawasaki 1-2 from Sykes, with Melandri 3rd, overtaken at the last corner again. Alex Lowe's in 4th, ahead of the Spanish Elvis 5th. Chaz Davies 6th. Nicky Hayden in 7th. Chavi Forres, whose brilliant start kind of petered out, didn't it? Where was he in Thailand? He finished 8th. With Roman Ramos 9th and Reiterberger 10th. First points, incidentally, of the season for Ricardo Russo, Andre Jesek, and Ayrton Badovini in race 2. You'll notice we haven't mentioned Aprilia. The less said, the better. Laverty broke down on the final lap of race 1 and then crashed in race 2 to finish 15th. They are bottom of the Manufacturers' Championship, which we'll get to in just a second. First, though, the Riders' Championship. Jonathan Rea leads it with a perfect 100. 30 clear of Chaz Davies in second. Tom Sykes is in 8 points further back in third. Then comes Lowe's in fourth. He has 49 points, which I think is around half of what he finished last season with. Marco Melandri's fifth on 45. Then comes Forres. He's still sixth. Torres is seventh. Van der Mark has dropped to eighth after an oil leak, which prevented him from taking the restart in race 2. Kamiya is ninth. And Nicky Hayden is into the top 10 in 10th with 21 points. The Manufacturers' Championship, as I mentioned, Kawasaki, 100 points, their top. Ducati are second on 76, courtesy of Melandri scoring their points in race 2. Yamaha have 50 in 3rd. Then come BM in 4th. They've jumped above MV Agusta. Honda are up to 6th. They're off the bottom because Aprilia have dropped to 7th with their 2013 chassis for Eugene Laverty.
How is that a thing?
We should mention that, actually. The fact that Eugene Laverty, since he's last ridden in Aprilia, it's clearly changed a bit. So they're trying to go back to something that he sort of recognises. But it doesn't say much, Dre, for their 2017 bike if they're going back 4 years.
And going back to the 20th century with Eugene Laverty's moustache.
Someone said as Max Biaggi made a comeback. when they looked at the picture of him, he looks very, very similar.
It must be in a prettier thing. If you join a pretty, you must have a Max Biaggi moustache.
But it's certainly not a go faster stripe, is it, at the moment? As I say, a pretty bottom of the Manufacturers' Championship in World Superbikes on 19 points from 4 starts, which ain't great, let's be honest. On to World Supersport. World Superbikes didn't exactly give us much entertainment this weekend, but Dre, World Supersport more than made up for it.
Yeah, it absolutely did. And, oh my gosh, another completely...
What was the description you gave it?
Batshit crazy. Out of 10 was what I basically rated it on. And World Supersport has stolen the show this year in terms of just sheer ridiculous races this year that... just completely throw out the rule book and then the form book on everything and anything you've known about World Supersport in the last 3 years. Like, you take Keaton Sefoglio out of the mix and then all hell breaks loose. Like, the dam of sporting convention has been blown wide open here, and yeah, it doesn't make any sense, but we are going to try and make some sense of what was one of the most bonkers World Supersport races I've ever seen.
Yeah. Well, let's try and tell the story of it then. Just stay with us, listeners, because this might take a while. Opening lap, we see Cluzel lead away from pole position. Now, halfway around the first lap, we see a rider completely out of control on the runoff, half crashing his bike and then spearing back across the field, somehow not hitting anyone. That was Nicky Tooley. Remember that name, because it'll be important later. Following on from that, we see a number of engines going pop. First of all, Zulfami Khairuddin, who was a guy who was in the top 10 contending for a win. His engine blows. At the same time, we notice Luca Mahias, the guy that nearly won in Phillip Island. He's gone missing. His bike's failed too. So he's out of the running. PJ Jacobson then disappears in a cloud of smoke. He's the guy that was on pole in Phillip Island and one of the title favourites. So he's out as well. While this is going on, we see Kyle Smith taking it upon himself to piss off every fan in the attendance by trying to carve up the Thai wildcards. He takes out Paul Amai, who was challenging for the victory. That lands him a penalty to drop 3 places, which he ignores. Out in front, Cluzel's leading the race. Then his engine blows up to take him out of the race, which leads us with a leading group of Federico Caracasulo and Decker Kreisart. That's because Christian Gamarino has also been taken out by Kyle Smith as he charges back through the field. Still with us. 2 laps to go. Kreisart is beginning to dream of a first win in World Supersport in front of his home crowd until Kyle Smith, who by this point has now been given a ride through for ignoring his penalty notice, carves him up and takes second. Well, not second, because he's out of the race. Because he's now been disqualified for failing to take his ride through. On the final lap, Kyle Smith actually nearly wins the thing by within another lap, he would have passed Caracasulo to take the lead of the race. He didn't, thankfully. Caracasulo crosses the line to take the win with Kyle Smith all over his rear taillight, but out of the race because he's been disqualified, he's been black flagged. And Kreisart comes through all of that to take second and a career best in front of his home crowd. And remember Nicky Tooley, that guy I told you about who nearly crashed on the first lap? He came through to finish third out of all of that. If you have not seen this race, and we've not even come close to doing that justice, go back and watch it, because it is, as Dre mentions, absolutely crazy.
It's so ridiculous, much
happening in that race. So let's try and pick it apart. Let's start with the winner, Federico Caracasulo. A maiden win for him, Dre, in World Supersport. And redemption for him, in a sense, as well, because he was, of course, the guy that torpedoed Cluzel on the final lap in Phillip Island.
Oh, yes.
So a nice way for him to redeem himself. And also, a strong start for Yamaha, who very nearly won in the first race of the season through Mahias, and they've now won race two with Caracasulo.
Yeah, good for the manufacturer's title that the Yamaha seems to have got some good riders on their bikes this year. Yeah, completely agree. Caracasulo, nice little redemption. I've actually forgotten that he'd taken out Clizette at Phillip Island, so I was like, oh yeah, that was him. And yeah, another talented young Italian motorcycle rider. I mean, they're growing on trees these days, aren't they? But yeah, exactly. Tremendous first win. Again, he controlled the race, and I mean, after Clizel's engine went pop, and he did a very good job of holding off what must have been a very game Chrysler, who was probably desperate for that first win. Again, not entirely Chrysler's fault, again, because of what happened behind him with Carl Smith and whatnot, but with everything that was going on around him, that was a pretty mature and responsible ride to take what was given to you there like that, and holding off Chrysler, who probably pulled the pin a little bit too early, but doesn't matter in the end. I mean, Caracasulo got there in the end. A very, very good win for him.
We have to talk about Kyle Smith, because he was kind of the guy that dominated the race. By dominated, I don't mean dominated by the front, he dominated the headlines, if you like, from that race. Now, this guy's also, like myself, he's a Yorkshireman, so he'd expect a bit of solidarity here, but in all seriousness, Dre, what the hell was he doing?
I have no idea.
I mean, even for a guy with the nickname Sideways Smith, I still wasn't expecting something quite like that.
Me and my brother were watching this. My brother's not the biggest superbike watcher out there. Even he was like, what the hell is he doing? Basically, it's like that old 500cc race in the late 90s when Max Biaggi, who's already been black flagged, wins the race out of spite.
Yeah.
Basically, so, it's just
out of spite, and out of spite, the TV directors refused to show it. They just didn't want to show him.
Yeah, I was like, no, sod this. Like, we're not putting them on TV. But yeah, Smith, in Smith's defense, like, he probably didn't see the penalty warning, because apparently Gino Ria didn't see it too. So, you know, take that what you will.
We can kind of defend that, but can we defend the move on Polamai and the move on Gamarino that kind of landed him the penalty?
What the hell was he doing going into that final corner? Like, he's clearly braked at least 20 meters too late.
Yeah, he took three of them.
Overtook three of them, and again, Camacho had to dive out of the way almost, because he was going to get speared if he kept that bike where he was, because there was no way Smith was making that apex, no way. And he ran wide at that same corner a couple of laps later as well, so it was obvious that, you know, he was misjudging his braking in that final corner throughout, because obviously he fixed it later on in the race. So it was clearly a rider error, and I just don't know what he was doing out there. And the fact he was carving up Chrysler for the win later on as well, when he's already basically been given a ride through penalty, it's like, what, I also hold his team partly responsible as well. Didn't the team tell him ride through on the pit board? Like, so it was Smith just so into the race that he just didn't read the pit board at all over the course of that race? I don't know. But it's just, what a bizarre behavioral trait from Carl Smith on that one. It just didn't really make any sense to me.
Yeah, because as you say, you can almost forgive the not seeing the black flag or the ride through, because Gino Ria did the same thing. He was given a ride through for failing to start at the back of the grid, because he arrived on the grid behind the safety car. Because he'd had a problem at the start of the formation lap and had to sort of restart his bike. So you can almost forgive that. But like I say, for me, the bigger issue is the moves he was putting on people. Like the move on Polamai that got him the penalty, which took him out, was crude, to say the least. I mean, we saw Chaz Davies put an amazing move on Sykes in race one at the fast right. out the back of the circuit. And it was almost as if Kyle Smith had saw that and thought, John, I'm going to have a go at that. And ended up running them both clean off the road. Polamyi then went down. That was the first of the Tai Wildcards. Then he proceeded to piss off the second one by getting involved in the fight for the win on the last lap of the race. Kyle Smith probably not welcome in Thailand anytime soon after what happened in that first race. Now, there were a number of engine blow-ups that kind of shaped this race. And they all seemed to happen to championship contenders, Dre, almost as if Keenan Sefolga was sat at home with a big red detonator button.
Watch this. 3, 2, 1, and there goes Jacobson's engine. It's like, oh, for God's sake. I find it amazing. Okay, maybe one title contender has an engine. Remember, like, Thailand had tricky conditions. It was 37 degrees out there during the race. Very, very hot indeed out there. Like, Jonathan Rea had his levers unzipped off the race, his race 2 win, like, while he was still on the bike. It was like, he looked like General Zod out there from Man of Steel. It was just like the entire jacket on already at that point. But yeah, it was very, very hot out there. So maybe an engine or two could go pop. All three title contenders all went boom. I just go, what kind of horrendous luck did I miss here? That all three of Keenan's main title contenders all had similar engine-related blow-ups in the same race. Yeah. Within the same maybe 15-minute time span even. It's just, it's ridiculous. And wow, just all sorts of crazy. Keenan, what's your lucky number? Can you tell me the lottery numbers for Sunday, please? Yeah. You know, just oh God, yeah, I can't.
One of those was Jacobson, who, as I mentioned earlier on, there were two factory MB Augustas that went pop in the space of about an hour and a half. Jacobson's was the first of them, which took him out. Mahias, who was second in Phillip Island, so he was probably the best placed of them, given that he had 20 points on the board and was looking quick in Thailand as well. So he's probably the guy that was looking to get the biggest head start on Sefolga in the points. Jacobson, who only got those 10 points from Phillip Island after basically fluffing his lines in the race, having put it on pole. But surely the guy that we have to feel most sorry for here, Dre, is Jules Cluzel, who was, as I mentioned, taken out by Caracasulo on the final lap in Australia, then puts it on pole in Thailand and looks like he's leading pretty comfortably until his Honda goes bang and he's still stuck in the starting gates. He hasn't got a single point.
Oh, like, Cazell's season might be over before it's even began, basically, because of those two incidents. It's a real shame. He's been so unlucky in that regard, where, again, through no fault of his own, he's got 0 points to his name. He doesn't deserve that at all. He could have easily had 50. He was winning that race in Thailand. He was comfortable out of there. And, yeah, like, taken out in Phillip Island from a solid position there. And, again, taken out by a blown engine, a blown Honda, shall I say, in race two, and a race he was leading from the front in. It was just, it's a terrible bit of luck, and it's a real shame because he deserves better. And yeah, like, Cruzel, now knowing he's lost two rounds to Keenan Sefolga and has no advantage to speak of whatsoever now.
Yeah, they're still points.
It's a brutal bit of luck. It really is.
Mm, yeah, and as we mentioned earlier on, the guy that was way out of control on that first lap and somehow came back to finish on the rostrum, what a ride. We didn't see much of it, Dre, but Nicky Tooley must have been hauling ass in that second race.
Yeah, we didn't see it on camera at all, but Nicky Tooley must have been just on it like a rocket. It was ridiculous, his pace, to be able to come through. Remember, the rest of the field was crazy. You had guys like Carl Ride in there as well, and obviously Smith recovering from his numerous mistakes. But for Tooley to come through there and finish in third, awesome stuff. Tremendous performance from him in the grand scheme of things. Again, Gregory Haynes had to correct himself, saying, like, wait, this isn't his first podium, because the guy's a quality rider.
Yeah, he clearly is. As a wild card on that KM Hyundai, where they finally now got the budget together to do the full season this year with Sheridan Marais as his teammate. And they're running the full season this season. And Tooley, through that podium, he's second in the points now, because he finished sort of fourth, I think he was, in Phillip Island as well. In that race where we saw so many guys getting taken out through crashes. Out of it all, though, Dre, somehow, despite a pants weekend in Thailand, where he qualified second last, finished 11th purely by dint of so many people dropping out ahead of him,
attrition.
Robbie Rolfo still leads the championship.
Go, Robbie Rolfo! Yes, we're bringing it back to the late 90s, people.
Yeah. It says a lot, doesn't it? When out of the first two rounds, 30 points from a possible 50 leads the championship.
Yeah, none of this makes any sense. None of it does. Forget this weekend never happened. Let's move on with our lives. Keenan is probably going to be back at Aragon in 3 weeks' time, and he's going to probably curb stomp everybody again because that's what Keenan does. So, yeah, forget this whole thing ever happened. The championship effectively starts in 3 weeks' time because none of us has given Robbie Rolfo a hope in hell here, basically. But, hey, it's nice to see him at the top of the leaderboard for two straight rounds. It's very funny.
It is.
The 36-year-old Robbie Rolfo is top of the championship. That's tremendous.
Yeah, because what was funny is I remember the commentary as it was going on with Greg and James Whittam, where they were talking about, like, Greg was like, oh, Rolfo's having a disastrous weekend. And James Whittam was like, well, yeah, but that's kind of what he was like before Phillip Island, wasn't it? That's kind of how he usually is. Like, Phillip Island.
That's the baseline.
Phillip Island was the shock where he was up there winning the thing. Which kind of shows how much of a fairy tale he's like, the Leicester City of World Supersport. Bless him. So here's how the race finished then in Thailand. If you predict this result, then go collect your winnings. Karakasudo, the winner from Kryzat and Thule. That was the podium. Titipong Warakorn, who was Sofwoglu's replacement on the Pachetti Kawasaki, he's another Thai rider. He finished fourth, ahead of his teammate Kyle Ride. He's very quietly having a very, very good start to the season. Hikari Akubo, who is one of the CAA Landor Insurance Hondas not to blow up, he finished sixth, ahead of Sheridan Marais on the second of the Kallio Yamahas. Aidan Wagner, eighth. He's the top Aussie. He's quietly as well had a very good start to the season. Ahead of Watanabe, the Japanese, in ninth, and Robin Mulhauser, who, of course, crashed out of that first race in Australia. He got 10th. Robbie Rolfo, as I mentioned, 11th, ahead of Lachlan Eppis, Nacho Calero, Davide Pizzoli, and for the second race in a row, we didn't have enough finishers to round out the points. Only 14 finishers in the second World Supersport race again. Which means the championship looks like this. Rolfo leads it, remarkably, 30 points. Thule second, 3 points behind him. Then comes Karakasulo, who's up to third on 25. Kyle Ride is fourth on 24, so he's just six off the lead. Kryzat is fifth on 20. Then come Mahias on 6th. He's also on 20. Aidan Wagner, the Aussie, is 7th on 17. Ahead of his fellow countryman, Anthony West, who bought a one-way ticket to Thailand in the hope that he'd find a bike, but he couldn't, so he didn't race. He's 8th on 16. Then comes Watanabe on 15. Sheridan Marais completes the top 10 on 14 points. Of the championship contenders, Jacobson is 13th on 10. Cluzel still has none. Same as Sofwoglu, who is likely to be back in Aragon and only has a 30-point handicap to overcome, and that's up against Robbie Rolfo, so he'll probably have that back in two races. It's been quite the start in World Supersport. Next round of the championship then, which I cannot wait for, is in Aragon in 2.5 weeks' time, when we'll also see the debut of the Supersport 300 class, as well as the return of the Stock Thousands as well. So plenty to look forward to when World Supersport returns and Superbikes in a couple of weeks' time. Right, let's do the news then, and not a lot of news to bring you because we're still, as I say, only in World Superbike territory. MotoGP and BSB start in the coming weeks, but we do have some BSB news, and this is quite some cool news, Dre, for anyone who's listening to this who lives anywhere near Donington, who fancies going to Donington next Wednesday, because if you fancy watching some BSB testing, you get in for free.
Hey, who doesn't love a good freebie?
And
but say, yeah, go on.
No, I was going to say, because what I think BSB are doing such a good job here is just making it accessible. Because Formula One testing has been going on not so long ago, and I was looking at some of the recent prices that are going around for Formula One race tickets. Now, I know it's racing we're talking about here, not testing, but BSB, and you can attest to this because you've been to around, they do such a good job of enhancing the fan experience.
Absolutely. The tickets are dirt cheap as well. Like, I think most of the time it's no more than maybe 40 quid for an entire weekend. And, you know, the fan base is incredible. Like, like they have every catering spot you could possibly think of on God's green earth at a race meeting. Take it from me, I had to try every single one of them. But in any case, they do a brilliant job of fan accessibility. They know the series is cheap. They know that the biggest priority is getting heads through the door and seeing their product, which is an excellent product. So they know that the priority is getting people to see what they're doing, and that they're doing a very, very good job of that. And hey, making testing free, that's superb. It's far better than getting on a plane to Catalonia to watch a McLaren blow up.
Yeah, as fun as that is. But no, if you want to, what you get to watch next week, actually, and we might as well just mention some of these, because for those that perhaps haven't followed the news over the off-season in BSB, you'll get to see Sylvain Guintoli on a factory Suzuki for the Build-Base team. Next week, you'll get to see Davide Giuliano on a Tyco BMW, which will be well worth watching. You get to see the new JG Speedbeat Kawasaki team, same team, name, different team. It's now the Quattro Plant team, essentially, Bournemouth team that we saw last year, with Leon Haslam and Luke Mossy. We'll see Shaky Byrne looking to do what Shaky Byrne does, and that's dominate again.
Yes.
In BSB. We'll also see the likes of Bradley Ray, who's moving up into BSB. He's a teammate to Guintoli next year. So much to keep an eye on. So much world-class talent now in British Superbikes for you to watch. The new McCams Yamaha team with Laverty, Michael Laverty, and James Ellison. So if you're anywhere near Donington, get yourself down there. And even if you're not, you don't even have to pay to get in. All you have to pay for is to get there. So if you've got nothing to do next Wednesday, I would suggest head to Donington Park and watch some free BSB testing. It will be well worth getting down there. TV broadcasting news to bring you before we move on to MotoGP testing. Because British Speedway has a new home for this year. We'll be covering Speedway as we go through the year when the Grand Prix series starts. But the newly named Speedway GB Premiership, which replaces the old Elite League, will be broadcast on BT Sport this year. Moving from its previous home of Sky Sports, which basically means that all the live Speedway in the UK will be all in one place on BT Sport. That is the Speedway GP Premiership, the Elite League, and the World Cup. They'll be all in one place. MotoGP highlights have a new home. Of course, the live coverage remains on BT Sport as well. But the highlights this year will be now on Channel 5, moving across from their new home of ITV4. And this is kind of important news, this, Dre, because we learned a couple of weeks ago that the MotoGP highlights were leaving ITV4. And I have to say, I'm not particularly convinced by the Formula E coverage I've seen from Channel 5. I'll be honest with you.
It's not been great, but
given that MotoGP needs as many eyes looking on it as possible, especially with a British talent team now coming into play, to have free-to-air highlights, particularly on one of the main five channels, can't be a bad thing for MotoGP, can it?
Yeah, Channel 5 is an infinitely better channel to have your show on compared to ITV4, which is still kind of a hipster channel, really, more than anything else. Interesting to see that ITV is having less motorsport than they've had invested in before, and it looks like players like Channel 5 is having an extended effort to get more of it on with Formula E this season, which, if I'm honest, hasn't been great. But hey, it's a highlight package. All you got to do is get a voiceover guy to present it, and you know they've already done the hard work for you.
The time zone is going to be important here, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. I mean, like, I know Walter has been on Channel 4 as highlights before, but they're like 2 in the morning or 6 in the morning, where it's just it's time filler. It's treated as filler, basically. So yeah, the time slot will be important in this one. I hope it's on a prime time slot or something close to that. I mean,
yeah, because they do
that
with WRC, don't they?
Yeah, it's like something like that, or we get another Gadget Show series rerun. So you know, rather that than anything else, you know.
Yeah, let's go for it. So let's hope. Let's hope MotoGP gets the coverage it deserves on Channel 5. It certainly gets the wall-to-wall live coverage on BT Sport, which starts next week. And we're going to cover that next, because we're going to talk testing, because the final pre-season test took place in Qatar last week, and we will cover that in just a moment. Right then, let's talk testing and the final 4 days of pre-season testing. About 3 days, should I say, in Qatar over the weekend. And not a lot really changed, did it, Dre? Because in the same sort of vein as the three previous tests, Maverick Vinales dominated again.
Yeah, it's becoming a pattern here, folks. Maverick Vinales is really good at riding motorcycles. It's been incredible. Like, it's like, I think friend of the show, Zara Daniela, said it very well when she said straight up, like, Maverick's now got the factory itch where he's got to be top of the timesheets now, whatever happens. And he's taken to this bike like a duck to water, and he's doing an excellent, excellent job on there. And I think he's sending shockwaves through the paddock, knowing that this kid is this quick on this bike very quickly. And Maverick said straight up at the end of the test, this bike is ready to race. He feels like they're ready to go, basically. And let's just say other people on the paddock aren't that confident in their own ability right now. Let's put it that way.
No, because what's kind of ominous is that those are the kind of words we heard Jonathan Rea saying around a month ago, weren't they?
Uh-huh, exactly, and that's a terrifying force.
Yeah, Vinales quickest on a 154.3 in the Qatar test, and he was quickest on two of the 3 days as well. He's the favourite, isn't he? He's got, I mean, a championship, not so sure, but surely he's the odds-on favourite for Qatar, the Grand Prix, in about a week and a half's time.
Has to be. How could he not be off the testing like that? That was ridiculous what he was doing out there.
They say you can only read so much from testing, but I think the signs are pretty ominous, aren't they?
Well,
you can't ignore them.
His teammate Valentino Rossi said straight up, Maverick is, and I quote, very, very fast, from what he said, straight up. And, you know, more on that Rossi dynamic later. But it's Maverick has to be favourite now. Like, he's looking terrifyingly fast out there in that Yamaha right now. And no one else has gotten within a good half second of what Maverick's been able to do all testing long. So, and yeah, if Vinales' race pace is up there and, you know, the track is in a decent state, he'll probably be favourite for Qatar, which is, again, a scary thought, but the kid is super fast.
Yeah, let's talk about his teammate while we're talking Yamaha, because as you mentioned, Valentino Rossi basically stating how quick he thought Vinales was, and I saw a quote from him on the second day where Rossi was second to Vinales on that day in history, where Yamaha had a 1-2-3 with Folger up in third. And I remember Rossi saying that he passed Vinales at one stage. He says, I managed to pass him on his one only slow lap of the winter. which was, I thought was great, seeing how basically amazing Vinales has been all winter, that Valentino finally managed to find him on a slow lap. He'd been searching for one all winter. But Valentino, he said out of his own mouth, and this is out of the Yamaha press release, so it's it's not like Yamaha have tried to airbrush this out. Valentino saying that, we are still not ready, and we don't understand 100% how to make the bike work at the maximum. Now, we said on the last show that Valentino is probably still going to be there anyway, because he always is, but there's no way that he would be this far down and struggling this much on purpose.
No, I don't think it's in Valentino to be like that. And the thing with Valentino is he's always been very honest, and he doesn't pull punches when it comes to these scenarios. He's a bit sly in how he goes about himself, but like, Rossi wouldn't lie about something like that. Like, not when it comes to the bike and his performance. He's always been very loyal to the brands he represents. So, yeah, like, it looks like Rossi is struggling in testing again, which for me means absolutely nothing, which means he'll probably finish fourth in Qatar, because that's what Valentino Rossi does. He makes the best out of bad situations. He's been doing that for the majority of his career. And he's Valentino. He always finds a way to get it done in the end, but it is very interesting to see the polarizing side of both of the Yamaha, and where Maverick is saying, it's ready to go, I'm ready to go, let's start Qatar already, god damn it, I'm really, really fast. Whereas Valentino Rossi is saying, we can't push at the maximum comfortably yet. It's a very polarizing camp. So, like, who's right, who's wrong here? Are they both right? Who knows? It's a very, very interesting dynamic that's going on right there, and there's no obvious answer here.
Yeah, and part of me wonders whether Maverick's also saying that, like, oh, well, I'm ready to go now, because he kind of wishes it did start now while Rossi's struggling.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, bank those points now while your teammate's in a bit of trouble, because if the Yamaha is that good, then, yeah, you've got to think that those two are going to be two of the three championship contenders this season. I think we all know who the other one's going to be, and that's the guy that defends the title, Marc Marquez. And yet again, that Honda just doesn't seem to like Qatar, does it, Dre? Marc Marquez spent most of the test in the bottom end of the top 10, and most of the test crashing, from as far as I could see.
Exactly. I mean, three crashes on the final day kind of says a lot, really, about where Honda are right now. I mean, Pedrosa very quietly went about his business and did some good work on the final day. But, like, Marquez, is this just the Marquez thing now where he's just going to, you know, override it in practice, see where the line is, and then know where it is, and then reel himself in for races? Because that's what Marquez has been doing pretty much his entire career so far. He's always used practice as a way to say, okay, I'm going to ride over the limit and see where the line is, and then we'll go from there. And let's be real here, Qatar is not the best place for testing. And I'm going to make a point of this now, because they start their test sessions in the day.
Yeah.
You don't bother running in the daytime because it's not representative of what the track's going to be at night. And then when it gets night, it gets cold, and therefore you get condensation on the track.
The dew comes down, yeah.
The dew comes down, the track is super slippery, and you can't ride at your best because there's a lack of grip on the surface.
Which was responsible for two of those three Marquez crashes as well.
Exactly. So it's hard to get a real gauge on just like as a test environment, it doesn't really make sense. So yeah, it's not ideal at all. And it's like, we got to take this with a pinch of salt because it's Marc Marquez.
It's a good point to make that, actually, because a lot of people always ask, why does the Qatar Grand Prix weekend in MotoGP run over 4 days rather than three? That's why. Because there just isn't a big enough window to get all the sessions in, while it's dark, and also before the dew comes down. So they spread it over 4 days. But finally, on Marquez, he's also referred to Vinales, and he says that, in terms of his own pace, he says, our rhythm is quite good, only Maverick is faster than everyone here. And he says that if they were able to race tomorrow, he should be able to fight for the podium. So even Mark is basically calling it and admitting now that Maverick's a level ahead of everyone.
Exactly. Like, Maverick looks like he could race tomorrow. I don't think anybody else, except maybe for the Tech Threes, who are always punching above their weight right now, and props to them for that. But yeah, Maverick looks like he's in a completely different league. I think Maverick could race tomorrow if it came down to it. And that's a terrifying thought for the rest of the field. I don't think anybody else is up there. Marquez had a good pace at Phillip Island. I mean, from what I know, Marquez's race pace was stunning out there at Phillip Island. So the bike is clearly fast. It's just a matter of, again, I think for Honda, it's finding where the line is. And then when Marquez finds the line, he'll be just fine, I reckon. But, like, so that's the thing with Marquez. He's the guy that can crash it a billion times and still win multiple races a season, because that's just what Marquez does. So he's such a freak case that he rewrites the rule book on these things. So we'll have to wait and see how this goes. Looking forward to seeing how it goes down, for sure.
Yeah, a lot of eyes, naturally, given that it's Qatar, were on Ducati, given how well they often go around there. And I think we had to avert our eyes on day two when we saw the new fairing, the Hammerhead fairing, as it's been affectionately, well, not affectionately, but that's how it's been titled. What on earth is that, Dre? of that Ducati.
It's a gopher. It's a gopher with two pieces of popcorn in its mouth. It's brilliant. Yeah, and
I said to Vikesh, one of our loyal listeners, the Rainmeister on Twitter, I said, yes, that's how I thought the Ducati often looked last year when Iannone had finished with it.
Yeah, that actually makes perfect sense. Oh my god, that bike looks like a disaster area. And Like, Lewis, have you seen all the journalists like Simon Patterson and David Emmett saying, oh, this is great, they look like prototypes now? Listen, I don't care if they're prototypes. I don't care if they're prototypes or not. Listen, ugly is ugly, no matter what the purpose is. Like, if it wins races, great, awesome.
I would have one question for these guys, who I respect greatly, because they're as good as good, the brightest and best brains in motorcycle racing, absolutely, journalism. But would they have looked at those appendages on the front of Formula One noses a couple of years ago and looked at that and gone, hey, that's prototype technology?
No, they wouldn't. They'd have said, oh, this car is ugly, bring back the 2007 cars and the V10s. Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, sure, okay, it might help them win a few extra rounds. Great, awesome, fantastic. It doesn't mean I have to say they look pretty. Like, that's, they can be mutually exclusive things, you know, guys. Like, you don't have to say, like, I was speaking to, again, a friend of the show, Frank Allchamps, about this, and she said straight up, you know, oh, I'd rather a team be daring. Great, awesome. If they win races, great. Well, if they don't, what are you going to tell me then? Oh, well, at least they tried. No. Listen, They can be as fast as they want. It doesn't mean they have to look nice. And fine, that's great. If it wins races, no one's going to care. But at the same time, it doesn't mean I have to actively say, oh, it looks great because it's a prototype part. No, it's ugly as sin.
Honda debuted, it didn't look quite like the Ducati, which, like I say, looks like a bit like a hammerhead. Looks like a hammerhead that's been hammered in
Batman.
The head. yeah, it does. And Honda debuted their own sort of aero fairing on the front of their bike, and that wasn't particularly great either. Is this getting out of hand, this? I know they had to do something with the regulations because they didn't want bikes that looked like the Ducati last year, where it just had it was sprouting wings at places where it already had wings. And it was getting to the point where it was dangerous, where if that bike crashes into someone, it's going to slice their leg open. And they've tried to get around that with this kind of fairing, which, if anything, looks even worse.
I guess, as they say in F1, if it wins, it will always look beautiful. But at the same time, I think this is getting a little bit out of hand.
Yeah, it's like, another example of the team's being a step ahead of the rulemakers here, doesn't it?
Exactly. Like it's motorsport. There'll always be loopholes, and when it's up to the guys that make up the rules to close those loopholes when they become open. We get it in Formula One all the time, where a team will try and find little ways of bending the rules, and then the rules have got to catch up and ban it. So, you know, that's how it is. It's how it's always been. So the loophole is now that we can have these wings as long as they're a part of the chassis overall. And now we've got bloated Ducati cheeks, Batmans on Hondas, and like the curvy Yamaha with slits down them in the inside of it. It's a weird dynamic. And yes, great for the PR company.
At least the Yamaha is slightly more subtle with it.
Yes, like again, it's great for the PR department saying, "Oh, great, you know, they're proper prototypes. They don't look like World Superbikes anymore." Half you guys don't care about Worlds anyway. Yeah. So, why do you suddenly care about Worlds needing differentiation because they're production bikes?
I haven't seen anyone getting confused between the two.
No, me neither. I've never seen that scenario before in my life. So, no, I am not going to go there with any of that shit, for me, quite frankly. So, for me, yeah, they're ugly, and I think it's... Like, you're going to put fans off the series because these prototypes have always been very nice-looking bikes. They always have been. And, like, we're moving into an era of aerodynamics now in bike racing. And, you know, of course, that's technology. That's inevitable. That's how it's always going to be. But it's not like in Formula One where you can make 3 seconds up with a bit of aero and making bigger tyres. It's not like that in bike racing. It's a different dynamic entirely. But for me, I think it's silly. I think it's silly, and no one has ever watched MotoGP and said, you know what, this needs more aerodynamics. we need more downforce on these bikes, you guys. No one has said this ever in the history of GP motorcycle racing. So let's cut this crap out already, guys. I mean, seriously, enough.
Yeah, and there's still no guarantee, by the way, that Ducati are actually going to race this. That's one point we should make. Of course, they tested it on day two with Dovizioso in Qatar, and you know there's no guarantee that's the bike that will actually race in the opening round. Much likewise with the Honda, so they may actually run with the bike that we've already been seeing so far in testing. But it was interesting where I remember reading it on Twitter that everyone was expecting something radical to appear on the Ducati at some stage, and I was like, there it is. That's what we were fearing. Time will tell whether Ducati raced that. But I mean, one thing we could probably guarantee, Dre, and I think we already knew this before the test took place, but it confirmed it, that LaSalle is one of those circuits where we can expect Ducati to be very much in the fight for victory, can't we?
Yeah, absolutely. Lorenzo was very fast indeed. And, you know,
Four in the top six.
Redding was up there on the GP16. Lorenzo has always been good around Qatar. Yeah, Bautista as well. I mean, Ducati is half the field. They're bound to get somebody in there, right? So, you know, in any case, yeah, they look very, very fast indeed. Yeah, I can't wait to see how it turns out and seeing where Lorenzo fits in and Dovi, because Dovi, again, has been up there as well, absolutely, all the time in Qatar. Yeah, very nearly won it last year and the year before. It was a tenth away in 2015. So, yeah, without question, I'm really looking forward to seeing how they fit into play because, again, Qatar has a habit of being a bit of an equaliser. Yeah, I can't wait. I can't wait for 2 weeks' time in the opening round.
Yeah, I don't think any of us can. Ducati's impressive showing in Qatar, well, I say impressive, it's kind of what we've come to expect now from them around there, came with a few fall guys, because one thing that I noticed, Ray, from the test in La Salle was that the Suzukis and the Aprilias were a lot lower down than they had been previously in the winter. Yannone Rins, Aleix Espargaró, and Sam Lowes, although that one's more expected given that he's a rookie, on largely 2016 parts for most of the winter, they were all outside the top 10. So are we to take from that that that's more a byproduct of the Ducatis being quicker than normal, or a Suzuki and Aprilia finding a circuit that doesn't necessarily suit them quite so much?
Yes, is a short answer for that one. Yeah, I'm not sure on this one yet, to be honest with you. Suzuki have not been
quick there with Vinales last year, weren't they, in Qatar?
Yeah, didn't they finish sixth there with him last year?
I think, as well,
front row in qualifying as well. So they've been fast, but again, I think the field has gotten faster, definitely. Like Ducati have completely now phased out the 14.1s and 2s out of MotoGP now. Everyone's on at least a 15, and that was the bike that pushed Ducati up the field a little bit further. So, by the looks of it, the field in general will be a lot quicker this year. The satellite bikes will be better. The Tech 3 guys are going to have last year's championship, you know, level Yamaha in their system as well. So the satellites are all going to be faster by default. Once they get their heads around these new bikes, they're all going to be up there, despite the disjointed nature of some guys being on 17s, like Petrucci, some guys on 16s, like Redden and Bautista, and some guys on 15s, like Baz and Carol Abraham. So once it all shakes out, we'll see how it goes down. But I think on paper, the field should be faster.
Yeah, absolutely. And yet again, you mentioned them there, yet again, the guys that perhaps many of us thought would suffer through all of the strong factory teams that we have are not struggling. That's Folger and Zarco and the Tech 3 Yamahas, who, if you look back at last year, it was Tech 3, particularly through Bradley Smith, that really suffered by dint of the Suzuki's being so strong, by dint of the factory and satellite Ducatis being so strong. But Folger and Zarco look like they're quick enough to rise above it all.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like, I think Jonas Folger
was third on day one.
Yeah, I think Folger and Zarco have been the biggest surprise in all of testing. I think that, like, Folger has adapted so quickly to MotoGP by the looks of it. I'm very impressed with Folger and Zarco. They look like they've taken to this bike very, very quickly indeed. They're right up there, like, in deep in the top 10 on testing times alone. Like, Tech 3 could be on a mini resurgence here by the looks of it. Let's be real, they've fallen down the order because Yamaha's given them less and less to play with, basically, as time has gone on. And Polo Spagger and Smith kind of suffered for it, but if they have a really good bike underneath them this year and they adapt to it quickly, Zarco and Folger could be in the top six easily. Like, there's no reason why they couldn't, because Ducati's struggling a lot on these circuits. So, yeah, I mean, I've been very impressed with Tech 3, and they've got two very, very good riders there with Folger. And if Folger, you know what Folger's like, he's got a ridiculous upside to him. Well, on his day, he's as good as anyone. And Zarco is Mr. Consistency. So they've got a very, very good team there, and if the Yamaha Tech 3 satellite package is any good, they'll be in the top eight for sure, no question.
And what's interesting, I mean, we won't look ahead too much because we'll do that on next week's season preview, but if you look at how strong the field is now and the fact that these guys are surprising us, you've got to think, you look at some of the big names now who are going to get a bloody nose in the early stages of the season, the likes of perhaps Rossi or Pedrosa or Lorenzo or Dovizioso, or, you know, any. Someone's going to finish eighth, and it might well be one of these very, very big names.
Absolutely. Like, there's no, like, look at Philip Island, for example, where he had like the top six within 5 seconds of each other. That could easily be someone like Lorenzo on a bad day, or someone, you know, again, on a Suzuki or a Yamaha or a top-tier Ducati like a Petrucci, for example. Yeah, there's no reason why they can slip down the order on a bad day, because, like, by default and by design with Dorna, they've decided to try and bring the field together with standardized electronics, and now them supporting the satellite teams by bailing out the bike costs. So on paper, they're designing the field to be closer and closer together. So we might see that come to fruition this year, for sure.
Yeah, the fact that the field is so close together has kind of come at a cost for one team, and that's the new team to MotoGP, and that's KTM, who found themselves at the bottom of the field in Qatar. And they're kind of the victims in a sense, Dre, of how competitive and how close MotoGP is now, because to their immense credit, KTM, around one of the longest circuits of the season, one that really tests the bikes, they were only 2 seconds off the pace of Javier Vinales. But unfortunately, these days, 2 seconds off means last place.
Yeah, that's the context of it's brutal. Like 2 seconds on the top, that would not be back of the field pace 2 years ago, but now that might be no points given how the field is now. And again, that you might have exposed a problem with this new format, and that might be a new team or a new factory taking part might have to take a year out basically to develop a bike that could be close enough. They're going to be playing catch up now because everybody else has got subsidized super bikes that Dorna's paid for them from the previous year's machinery and whatnot. So it's probably going to make the catch up job that much harder.
Yeah, it is. And you look at the times from their two riders, who we've said so many times, haven't we, that how evenly matched they often are. Bradley Smith, 21st, Paul, 22nd, just a tenth of a second apart. Bradley on a 56.3, Paul on a 56.4, which kind of tells you that bike won't go any quicker than it's going, because they're both on pretty much the same level with it. So KTM, Bradley Smith was very honest, where he said that they're in touch with a couple of guys, those guys being Lowe's and Rabat, but they need another half second to be in with that midfield group, that group that are fighting for points. Because 1.2 seconds covers the top 18.
Come on!
And then it's another 6 tenths back to Sam Lowe's, Rabat, Smith, and Espargaro, and Callio was there on
test.
Here's the full rundown of how it finished in Qatar. Vinales quickest at 154.3. That was 700ths clear of Dovizioso in second. Then came Pedrosa, Lorenzo, Bautista, and Redding, completing the top six. Folger, seventh, first of the Tech Threes, ahead of Crutchlow in eighth. We're still within half a second of the lead time here, by the way, in eighth. Zarco, ninth. And Marc Marquez was 10th, 0.6 off. Rossi, 11th. Then came Iannone, Abraham, Rins in 14th. Aleix Espargaró, 15th, 1.1 off. And then came Miller and Baz and Petrucci, 1.2 off in 18th. Then comes Sam Lowes in 19th. Tito Rabat, 20th. He was back from injury, of course, in Qatar. Bradley Smith, Paul Espargaró, and Mika Kallio on the three KTMs, because Kallio was their test rider, 21st to 23rd, all in the 156s. Which a couple of years ago would have been a very, very fast time around Qatar, but it ain't anymore. Unfortunately, you've got to be in the 54s if you want to be on pole position, which is where Maverick Vinales probably will be in a week and a half's time, where we hope to see the return of Hector Barbera as well, who, of course, missed this test through injury. That just about does it for this week's edition of Bike Live, Dre. And as we mentioned earlier on, our next show next week will be season preview time. But before that, Motorsport 101 returns a little bit later this week. Tell us what's coming up.
Tell us what's coming up. You put me on the spot here, haven't you, son of me?
You're recording it later today.
Yeah, we are going to later today. We'll probably be talking about IndyCar in St. Petersburg, more from testing in the F1 car launches, and we'll be bringing back the mailbag as well, so your questions will be on there as well. But a lot to take away from IndyCar in St. Petersburg. Sebastian Bourdais going from last to first to win in classic Sebastian Bourdais champ car fashion. Honda looking like that may actually be better than Chevrolet this year, which is very interesting indeed, that 7 of the top 10 were Honda finishers, and all the other usual calamitous fan base hijinks and me getting mocked over my fantasy team, because of course that's what we do around here these days. Motorsport 101, that'll be out later this week for sure.
Yeah, you thought your fantasy team was going to get mocked, but I think your meme might let you off the hook there, Dre. You may be all right on that one. As I say, next week we'll be back, and like I say, what a huge week this is for us next week, Dre. Two season previews to come next week. Formula One season preview on Motorsport 101 next week, but also here on Bike Live, we may struggle to keep this one down time-wise, because we have MotoGP, Moto2, and Moto3 to preview.
Absolutely, it's going to be absolutely banzai. There's so much to talk about in all three classes. Again, MotoGP looks set for its most competitive season we've ever seen. Six factories involved, and again, Sutterby said it himself, the top 18 within 1.2 seconds around Qatar. That is insane for a nearly 2 minute lap of a circuit. So yeah, for that to be
Moto2, we have KTM into Moto2, and a big group of rookies into Moto2 for the first time in a long time, which is just absolutely what that class has needed. That class is looking wide open this year for the first time in a long time. And Moto3 is Moto3.
Exactly.
We'll preview that as well. That's all to come next week here on Motorsport 101 when we bring you episode 4 of Bike Live, our MotoGP, Moto2, Moto3 season preview. Until then, it's my thanks to Andre Harrison and my thanks to all of you for listening to this edition of Bike Live, and we will see you again next time. Bye for now.
I'm really sorry that I couldn't be on the show again, even though I promised the guys, and they're probably going to kick my ass next time they see me.
Yes.
But I'll promise you 100% I will be on the next episode, even if I'm walking around the pub with the microphone attached to my ear or something. Life is not going to get in the way of being on the next episode of Bike Live. I promise you that. And I'm going to pass that as my proper debut, but thanks for listening tonight, and I'm really sorry.
Guys, if she's not on this episode, we're going to use this as our intro for next week's show.
Yeah, we told you she was coming on this week, guys. We told you.